If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Axar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny. Greetings in the light and love of the one divine source. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you're listening to the voice of the Axar Command. You know, beloveds, I am so full tonight of the bounty and the beauty of a very, very full spirit. But I just pray that I can share with you and impart energetically something of great, great boundless. In fact, our topic tonight is boundless riches and resources. That's a good one, don't you think? So we'll start out with a saying by Walt Whitman, who is a spiritual traveler, by the way. And I say to any man or woman, let your soul stand cool and composed before a million universes. So let's do that. Let's take that right into our own essence and take a deep breath. And feel that anointing of the Holy Spirit just chill down right over your whole body. And allow the world and all of its crazies to just roll off you. Just shake it off like your dog shakes water out of his coat after a good old dunk in the pool. Just shake. Let everything get out of you that doesn't need to be in you energetically. Just release it. And now, just take another deep breath. And call yourself forward to activation and empowerment through the office of the Christ, the order of Melchizedek, the great central sun throne realms. And present yourself in your multidimensional wholeness, integrated here and now. And allow your awareness to transcend and ascend you up, 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 to where you take a positioning out into the vastness of this beautiful, beautiful, open-ended creation. Feel the cool breeze of the cosmos. Every star, every planet has its own particular melodic refrain. It's called the music of the spheres. But scientists have actually been able to record the sounds and the tonalities of these wonderful worlds within worlds, all inhabited by sons and daughters of one God. So allow yourself to stand unadorned, unsupported by anything except your own divine, unlimited beingness, and stand in the midst of the cosmos in your inner awareness. And listen to the sounds of the planets and the suns and the stars singing. Listen to the voices of your brothers and sisters of countless worlds singing and laughing and bringing their own particular unique resonance to bear and to share. Now you sound forth your own particular sound. Just let it be whatever occurs to you to sing forth. I'll do mine silently. There, beautiful. And there you have the chorusing of the celestial host, of which you are part. And now just look and see the endless expanse of worlds within worlds, shining like, how can you even describe the magnificence of so many sparkling diamond points of light and life and joy and boundless richness, boundless abundance. And you are part of that eternally and forever. And you needn't even leave your own house to be present everywhere, in every place, throughout creation. So put out of your mind forevermore distance and separation, because these things are simply not so. You are connected to every single life form, every atom, every quark of existence is impressed with your soulific essence. And we partake of one unified field of life that we call God. So just take that on board and luxuriate in it. And let it impart to you a sense of the blessedness in which you exist. Everything, my beloveds, will pass away, but you shall live eternally in this boundless creation, this boundless, open-ended splendor. And you shall go forth from glory to glory, revelation to revelation, in ever more exquisite creative endeavor. And now we see way, way below, using an up and down, forgive me, we're going to have to do that, but that's the language we have here. Oops. At that beautiful little blue and white marble that you call your home, at least for this episode of embodiment. And let's just turn our focus to the earth. And with your brothers and sisters that you sense all around you, let's just do a flyover and watch the dawning of the new earth. And just as the darkness is replaced by the light, see the gradual brightening of earth. And wherever that sun passes over the earth, see it very, very, very intensely green, beautiful, pure, clear water. Let's go way beyond into the future now and see it ringing and singing with joyous, abundant, beautiful, bountiful life. Let's see all the world bathed in peace and joy and happiness. Everyone completely nourished and supported, loved and sustained, co-sharing this beautiful planet and adorning it with beautiful creative expressions. Everywhere you look, you see beautiful, exquisite architecture and artwork and singing and dancing and beautiful sculpture. Everywhere you look, people are celebrating life. And we just place our blessing. Just open your palms and allow the blessings of your heart chakra and your palm chakras and your brow chakras to join in a diamond pattern of blessing and light. And we say, Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu, may all the worlds be happy. Sarve Jana Sukhino Bhavantu, may all the people be happy. And we bless them. And we take a deep breath. We become present in this place, but with the remembrance of this higher vision imprinted indelibly upon our mind. You know, the movement of awareness to a positioning beyond the temporal is really the secret to living in spirit now, where you're not putting off to a arbitrary point in the Gregorian calendar, which is totally off anyway, something that is supposed to happen at a certain date that's going to somehow make things different. Could we just dispense with that kind of thinking and begin to move to that abundant place now? It's interesting that one picture of reality or another will hold us to that particular worldview. You can't really look into the world, the material world, for fulfillment of your material desires and at spirit at the same time. You have to make a choice. Are you going to look through the eyes of the eternal, or are you going to look through the eyes of the flesh? Because what you look for, you will find. The world is simply a reflective mirror that meets you at the point of your gaze and your expectation. That's why there's so many different worldviews. But when you stop to think about it, what is a worldview but simply a personal interpretation? It's an interpretation that's been placed upon something that is, in truth, highly neutral, completely without definition except the electrical impulses that impulse at the back of your brain, your particular internal movie camera, your little movie projector, and the little cluster of cells about the size of a peanut in the back of your skull. And those little electrical charges give you your picture of reality. You know, in the Eastern teachings, these impressions that form our reality are called ingrained tendencies or samskaras or vrittis. And these are the grooves that repetitive experience and the immersion of human identification produces in our consciousness, which gives us our tendencies that we carry from life to life. And blessed is the person who has come to such a degree of ripening as a soul that they come in and automatically begin to gravitate towards that upper vision of spirit. They just seem to be born with a leaning in that direction. Whereas a younger soul will be driven almost entirely by the unconscious desires that they have no control over. You will see that in nations too, nations that are more matured and nations that are composed of younger souls. And the latter will be extremely reactive and the former will be more in the mode of diplomacy and working things out through mutual life enhancement. So today we have so very many different levels of maturation of souls in the various nations of the world. And then you have the souls that are born today in these highly complex society, such as our Western industrial nations. And many of the souls born in these Western industrialized nations are old souls, but they've become completely, in many, many cases, overly identified with the material world, to where they have lost sight of their ingrained tendencies, which were basically to birth as a leadership the golden age, and to put money and resources into funding the golden age. Not to build bombs to kill and destroy, to fund the golden age. A golden age in which no child goes to bed hungry, in which no one has a medical need that is not addressed, in which everyone has the wherewithal for a decent life. You know, it's said, interestingly enough, in one of the Christian churches, that only about, I think it was something like 30% or less of Christians tithe, give 10% of their income regularly to the work of charity. That if 100% did that, we would not have need for any kind of other assistance on the planet, because everyone would be taken care of. We wouldn't need any other funding. So this building the golden age is something that every single one of us that is awakened or in process of awakening needs to tuck in and find a place to participate in, so that you put investment of time, energy, money, focus, prayer, meditation, visualization, and blood, sweat, and tears if necessary, into whatever is your lot in life to contribute. I'm always amazed when I find so many light workers that have the time to self-indulge in negative moods. I think, you know, you have an awful lot of time on your hands to sit around and indulge in that negative state. So if you find yourself going repeatedly into negative states, or depressions, or whatever is the negative pattern, begin to look and see where you are just getting stuck and staying stuck in an old pattern that could be better moved through your life by stepping out in service unconditionally in any area. I don't care what it is. The very secret of joy is to participate fully in life, in self-giving. The more you give yourself away, the more you will be filled, because we are here to be used and to give away whatever we have, our love and our joy and our peace. These things are contagious, and they will spread. Just as depression and irritation is highly contagious. In fact, you folks that enjoy your flu seasons, do you know what flu comes from? It's an astral disease, as is the common cold. The reason they haven't found a cure for the common cold and for flu is because it's an astral condition that's made up of stress, worry, fear, and concern. And that is what creates your flu epidemics. Isn't that interesting? And interesting, too, that they tend to come before the major holiday where you're called to spend so very much money. Christmas, Hanukkah, you know, the holidays, and the recovery from those holidays, which falls in, you know, February, January, February. So it's very, very important for us now to make a definite shift into a new perspective, what we really choose now to bring into our life and to act from. You know, the richest person in the world, really, is the person who has neither needs nor wants anything. That's the person who's really, really rich. But you know, without the tests and trials and struggles that the material element of life presents to us, we probably would never draw upon the inner resources that we have and ultimately come to find the inner riches that nothing in the material world can rob us of. You know, when I was in college, you know how sometimes things, you'll hear many, many talks, but only a few will be indelibly imprinted on your mind? Well, this was one of them. I went to hear a lecture by Swami Satchidananda. And I remember clearly his talk all these years later. And he asked how many of us wanted to experience peace. And mind you, this was the love, peace generation of youth that he was addressing. So just about everyone's hand shot up, including mine. And he said, well, then make a list of all the things you think you own. And the longer the list, the further you are from peace. And that stuck in my mind. It's like, oh my gosh, because at that point I had a pretty long list of things that I thought I owned. One of them being my body. And he went on to describe how we own nothing, not even our physical bodies, nor our length of years or days upon this earth, nor anything on the earth. Everything, including our breath, belongs to God. Well, I wasn't quite into that at that point in terms of realization. I am in that realization today. And so perhaps the talk tonight is more the musings of a mystic, because my whole life has been one of being intensely aware of the presence of the divine. And just about everything that I see and experience, good, bad, and whatever, reminds me of God. I have so associated life with the divine element that I don't ever at any time see it apart from that. Now, you might say, well, you have good karma. Actually, I came in with a tremendous amount of physical karma, which meant a lot of physical illnesses, including terminal so-called diagnosis, which I was healed of, and many, eight operations. And lots of illness, lots of physical pain, lots of challenges, lots of loss. I guess maybe 67 people that have been close to me have passed away, including my first spiritual teacher, which was devastating to me at the time. I've had a very, very, very difficult life, very challenging. But because I have also experienced the full gamut of life. There's very little I have not experienced. When it comes to material things, I've had everything you can imagine and have been reduced all the way down to social welfare. So I've had, and I've been in mansions, and I've been homeless. I've had all of these spectrums of experience. And I'm grateful for every single experience I've had, because when I speak and when I teach, it's out of direct experience of applying spiritual principles which have worked and worked and worked. And I don't share anything with you that hasn't been tried in the crucible of my own life and anointed with the experience that I bring to bear in the sharing. So all of our problems arise out of this human, what would you call it, ingrained samskara, to want to latch on to ephemeral things, the passing forms in the shadow land that we're just briefly passing through. If you look at your life, kind of like you're visiting a county fair, okay? You're just visiting a county fair. You're looking at the sideshows. You're eating some cotton candy and drinking some lemonade and going on the Ferris wheel and seeing the, you know, the animals and whatever, going through the spooky house. but you're not going to stay there. You're not going to, you know, you never go to a county fair thinking you're going to stay there forever. And you don't try to hold on to the experience when you're on the Ferris wheel or whatever you're on, the tilt and whirl or whatever. you know, you don't try to recapture that experience as soon as you get off. I mean, if you do, you get back on the ride again. But our problem comes when we keep wanting to hold on to that which has already been experienced and re-experience it again and again. But if you do that, you never are open to the boundless delight that the universe has in unfolding ever new, more wondrous experiences for you. Why limit yourself to one experience? John Roger put it very well to me one time. He said, you're like an omnidirectional mic. God will pick up on you wherever you are on the stage. You don't have to be in one place on the stage. He will pick you up. So, you know, nowadays we have those kind of mics that go into a headset. So the mic is right by your mouth. You don't even have to hold it. But God will pick you up wherever you are. God is. And in that, you can afford to be very daring do in your life. Goodness knows I've been daring do in my life. I did something which many young people in my generation wanted to do, but I actually did it. Many wanted to run away and join the circus. Well, I didn't run away. I was actually driven by my wonderful mother to join the circus, and we drove from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where I was living at the time, and to Richmond, Virginia, and I joined the Poodle Hannaford bareback riding family, very famous British family, and started my career as a circus performer. And I later on, after a couple of years with the Hannafords, I joined the Alberto Zoppé Group, which was an Italian bareback riding family. And they were intermarried with the Wallendas, the great Wallendas of high wire fame. And I was trained in aerial work with the Wallendas. And I used to do what's called a slide for life, where I'd slide hanging by my teeth down a long 45-degree slanted wire, very, very long slide, about 150 yards on an incline, very fast. The last little bit, they blew a whistle, and I'd reach up and apply my braking device. And I remember the first time I did it, I passed out, absolutely cold, because you don't have any kind of safety harness on at all. You're just hanging, in my case, by your teeth. And I gave myself a good extra swing because I wanted to be very daring, even though I was very frightened. And I went down so fast that I couldn't hear the whistle. And so the people down at the base of the wire made a flying tackle and grabbed me. You know, it's a wonder they didn't take all the teeth out of my mouth, to stop me from crashing into the end of the, rigging. And I passed out cold. So I was terrified doing this slide for life. And, you know, I had to do it any time from 2 to 3 to 4 times a day, depending on how many shows we had. And I'd wake up in the morning thinking, oh, no, I've got to do this slide for life. Oh, no, we've got 4 shows today. And that was not counting the other acts I did, because I did everything from working with the elephants to doing the bareback riding act. That was a misery, too, because I had rather weak arms. And there was one particular act where I had to stand on my hands on a galloping horse. And I didn't know how to lock my elbows. And if I didn't lock my elbows, I would collapse down on the horse and fall. I made my life absolutely miserable. So growing up as a teenager in the circus, and I did that from the age of 13 until I was almost 20, and then I left and went home to live with my dad and to attend university. But all of this time, it was such a wonderful discipline because I was constantly having to go beyond my sense of limitation. I had to constantly override my fear. I had to learn self-confidence. You know, when you're working, and in those days, you see, we didn't have safety nets. They put in a law after almost all of the Walendas took terrible, terrible falls. Many of the ones that I grew up with were either killed or permanently injured. It was terrible. That's why they later on became known as the Flying Walendas, even though they were a high wire act. Their falls, you know, they were called that afterwards. And my gosh, you know, when you're working 100 feet, sometimes 60 to 100 feet in the air over a cement floor with all kinds of rigging and all sorts of sharp things sticking up, you don't survive a fall like that. Or if you do, you're crippled severely for the rest of your life. So my life was one of facing fear and death every single day. And what makes a person do something like that for a living? Well, it's like anything else. You psych up. You learn to psych up to do what you have to do. And the circus people live very, very close to God. In fact, every time you'd see a performer before they would go out, I would see the Walendas and the Zopes, and all of the performers would cross themselves. Most of them were European Catholics. And they had a very, very close connection with God. So, and you have to, because you never know when that's going to be your last, you know, moment on earth. But it's also made me a very courageous light worker and a very courageous spiritual traveler, because I know what it's like to have such a trust and confidence, not only in yourself, but in God, that you know that with God's help and God's grace, there's nothing you can't do. In fact, I remember watching the great Carl Walenda when he walked on a high wire across the Niagara Falls. In fact, they wanted me to do a slide for life across the Niagara Falls, but then they figured that the wind velocity might, you know, break my neck. So they decided that wasn't a good idea, although I was up for it. But Carl Walenda walked across a high wire over Niagara Falls, and I remember that showed it on television, and every step he was talking to Jesus. This is for you, my Lord. This is for you, Jesus. I can do this because you're with me, Lord. I dedicate this to you, my Jesus. All the time talking to the Lord. It was so moving and so beautiful. And that's how we're meant to live life. So attuned to the Lord that every moment we are conversing and communing with Him in spirit. You know, we talk to ourselves all the time, but that's really a waste of time. You're just basically talking to your, what are you talking to? But if you can learn to commune with the Lord within you, just like you talk to yourself, just always keep speaking to the Lord under your breath and talk to Him about everything in your life. And that's how I learned to live in the circus, being frightened, being alone. I didn't come from a circus family. I joined the acts as an apprentice. And they don't have that sort of thing anymore, but I was part of that last generation that came under the apprenticeship process, which basically means you're a slave. You do all the grunt work, all the dirty work, and in exchange you're taught a trade, which was the way it was with me. So anyway, this sense of boundless resources is tested to the max when you're in an environment like that. I remember we went bankrupt. The whole show went bankrupt one time in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. We were down to just the Zope troupe had money. Nobody else in the circus had any money. All of the trucks and the trailers and everything had broken down. There was just a few of us left. And we were hungry. We didn't have any food. We didn't have anything. And I remember one day looking out the trailer window and seeing this long line of cars and trucks and all sorts of stuff coming to the circus. And these were people that were the bakers and the you name it. They were bringing food, and they were bringing hay for the livestock and meat for the lions. And this whole long group of people were coming from town to rescue the circus. And it was amazing, some of the things that we went through. And, you know, I didn't want to complain because I knew that my mother would whisk me home so fast if I ever complained. But I remember one time I hadn't eaten for several days, and I was extremely hungry. And I had on a pair of high heels that had great big holes in the bottom, and it was snowing. And she took me out to eat. My mother came to visit. Of course, I didn't say a word about any problems. And I guess I crossed my legs or something, and she saw the bottom of my shoe, which was a great big hole, and bare feet out in the snow. Well, she had a fit, absolute fit, that her daughter was in that condition. But I never, never complained because I didn't want to go home. You know, the deal was if I kept up my studies that I could stay in the circus. So I was fulfilling my deal, and my mother was allowing me to stay, you know, as long as I kept my grades up. So I learned to really be resourceful and to really trust myself. I developed tremendous self-confidence by constantly being pitted against things that were too hard, too scary, too impossible. And then somehow the Lord would see me through. Carla Walenda, the daughter of Carl Walenda, and I were teenagers growing up. We're the same age. And we survived the Cuban Revolution. We ended up being caught in the midst of the Cuban Revolution. This was during the time when Castro marched into Havana. Batista, you know, took off. And we were stranded. We had been there with Circo Nacional de Cuba. And we had been there for a couple months. Beautiful, beautiful show. When all of a sudden, overnight, everything just went crazy. And we were caught in the middle of this revolution. We were stranded at the top of this big hotel, which they were using for a fort, you know, to shoot from. So we couldn't come downstairs. We couldn't get, you know, any food. It was... You know, for two teenage girls, it was exciting and fun, and, you know, we remembered it as a big adventure. But actually, it was quite scary. And I think I was the last American to get out of Cuba because, you know, I was in an Italian bareback riding act, and they didn't realize I was an American. Everybody else had been evacuated. So my father, who was a colonel in the Army, was going crazy trying to find out, you know, my condition, how, you know, if I was safe and so forth. Anyway, I got home safely. Immediately kissed the ground when I got off the airplane and went and had the biggest hamburger I could find and the biggest milkshake and the biggest thing of French fries I could wrap my little teenage mouth around. But, you know, you learn a lot of things when you've had a life that has been so much in the red zone, in the danger zone. Another thing, I've done a lot of traveling. And one thing I've noticed in the third world countries, is that people with less materially are in general a lot happier than those of us in this consumer technology-crazed industrial group of nations. I notice they smile and laugh a lot more. They seem to, they have a ready humor. They're just always finding something to laugh and be joyful about. And they don't seem to have that stress that we have. They don't have those furrowed brows and that desperation. They live quietly, and they live accepting very philosophically the kind of lives they have. They're also far more generous. They share openly whatever little meager, whatever they have, they share it. They have a remarkable absence of juvenile delinquency. The elders are actually respected and listened to and cherished, and they're not put away in some convalescent home. It's just amazing how they honor life in these countries, particularly India. I'm so impressed with India, but I also spent a lot of time in the Latin American countries. So they have this tremendous faith in God, and faith in God and family really forms their whole sense of security. And even though their education, in many cases, is either not at all or considerably less, they seem to have a greater fundamental wisdom about life and a sense of connectedness. It's so remarkable. And so they're very philosophical in their approach to the major issues of life and death, and they're accepting, and they just have this natural way of being at ease in their skin and at ease with their environment and whatever life dishes out for them. They have a remarkable ability to roll with the punches and to make the best of even the simplest of circumstances. Doesn't take much to get a party going over there, but it has nothing to do with drinking. Their parties will be celebrations of the gods. They'll have a Ratha Yatra, a celebration where they'll carry one of the images from the temple in parade. They'll do the pujas. They'll sing bhajans, the sacred devotional songs, that sort of thing. The fireworks. They like fireworks, things that go bang and sparkle. But simple, really, really simple, but joyful. And they start their day with prayers. You'll hear the little puja, little bells ringing everywhere. You'll smell incense, and you'll hear people chanting in Sanskrit everywhere in the village. And I haven't actually encountered, that I can recall, any evidence of depression, hopelessness, panic attacks, or stress disorders amongst the simple people in the villages. I'm talking about the really simple villages of India, not the big cities. The big cities are gradually becoming as crazy as most of us are familiar with in our cities now. But exposure to the Western world view through television and films is now shifting this somewhat, and the big cities are developing very similar stress-related disorders to that we have now, unfortunately. But I suppose it's all part of that maturation and development that a soul goes through, where you're tested. You have to be tested, because if you never have something, then you don't know what you're missing. So then you have lifetimes where you have that whatever it is, full access to it, and then you come to the point when you say, okay, I've had enough of that. Now, I'm ready for an incarnation in which I really prioritize being of service and cultivating my spiritual gifts. So the important thing that we need to learn to really do is to pick ourselves up and stir up our gifts. Stir up our gifts. You don't know if you have something if you haven't stepped out and exercised it, if you haven't moved into actually attempting to do it. You got to step out somewhere and start doing the thing that you know in your spirit you're being called to do, because that's what you want to do. That's the call of spirit. When you really want to do something, that's it. Go with it. I remember a man coming up to John Roger, my spiritual teacher, and saying, John Roger, he said, can I be a healer? And John Roger looked at him and says, well, I don't know. Can you? And he said, well, that's what I'm asking you, JR. Can I be a healer? He said, well, you'll never know if you don't step out and start doing some healings. And that seems like such a simple thing. But very often people will not step out on what they know they're to do. They wait to have somebody's approval. Or they wait and get umpteen trillion different degrees, and then they don't do anything, because it seems to me like the more you know about something, the less likely you are to do it. I know so many people who have degree upon degree upon degree in counseling, but they're not doing any counseling. They have degree after degree after degree in teaching, but they're not teaching. And I'm talking about spiritual teaching, not going into an educational facility. So, and then there's, people like myself that just has always done it. I haven't, gone to all of these schools, gotten all these degrees. I've just always had the ability, and I've always stepped out and just done it. And the degree of doing is the most valuable degree. Because when you've learned through your own trial and errors, and you've got to make errors, you've got to make mistakes, to learn something, my gosh, the number of times I have fallen trying to learn to do the bareback act, for example. Oh, my gosh, I was under those horses and all over them and had more bruises than I had muscles at sometimes in my life. And sore, my gosh, I could hardly get out of bed in the morning. I would hurt so bad from strained muscles and sprained ankles and so forth. And it's just a way of life. You just tape up those suckers and you put on that liniment and you just keep on doing it. Nobody pays attention to that in the circus. You just tough it out. That's how I was trained to work. So the point I'm making is that you got to get in there and get dirty. got to fall down and get yourself all messed up every now and then. But better to make a mistake, being obedient to the call of your heart and the call of your spirit, than to sit back passively and never dare to step out to do what you know in your heart God has made you to do. You know you have that yearning, that desire, that passion, that fire. But you got to keep it stirred up yourself. That discipline of where, when nobody's around, you do what works for you regardless. You do what works for you regardless. So if, say for example, the Lord would walk in and catch you at any point during your day, you would not be embarrassed. You could just like, oh, hello there, Lord. Come in, sit down, have a cup of tea. Because that's how we live when we are in that process of spiritual adeptship, when we are becoming adept in the walk of light and the mastering, the self-mastering that goes into that. We learn to self-generate, self-recreate, self-activate, self-motivate. And it's an inside job. It has to do with where you place your thoughts, what comes out of your mouth, what goes into your mind, and what comes into your life by your invitation and solicitation, and what you keep out with your own self-imposed boundaries. Because certain things just do not have an option if you want a higher life of the spirit. Certain things do not have an optional wiggle room in your life. And these would be forms of all forms of dissipation that waste your energy and waste your life force and destroy your health. Those addictive patterns have to go. And they're bondage forms that keep you in bondage to the limited and the small and don't allow you to move beyond them into that greater, vaster life that you know you've incarnated this time to exercise. Bear in mind, this life is not like any other that you've had. And consider this. You've had millions of fathers and mothers and children and pets and lovers and spouses and all of that. And you've had the jewels and the palaces and the kingdoms. And you've also had the poorhouse and the being the beggar in Bangladesh or wherever. You've done all of these roles. But this lifetime, if you're listening to me, you are a light worker. You're one of the celestial emissaries here on Earth assignment. And you probably have volunteered to come in this time to be of service. And very likely you will not incarnate again. This is your opportunity to step free of that wheel of reincarnation, to make this your last lifetime, to make this the lifetime in which you put the frosting on the cake and those last little flourishes of that you want to really have in your Akashic record. So when you look back on the home videos and the Akashic planes of your lifetime, you can look at this life and think, wow, I really gave it my best shot. This one is a perfectly beautiful jewel. I think we're going to want to do that. We're going to want to feel good about ourselves when we step out of this realm. Yeah, it's an illusion. Yeah, it's a holodeck. Yeah, it's a stage play. But what actor, when they're on the stage, doesn't want to give the best downstage front center performance of their life, even though it's all pretend, it's all make-believe? Every actor wants to be an Academy Award winner or an Emmy Award winner, whatever. We don't want to give a slipshod, yucky performance. That's just the way we are. So it's very important to think about these things, to muse upon them, and to make your life a mystical, majestic offering. And only you can do it. Only you can deprive yourself of that. And don't let your flesh win. You know, we're all self-indulgent and lazy on some level, but you don't let that part of you run you. You're never going to feel like doing spiritual things all the time. You just aren't. You're going to want to give in to your flesh. But every time you give in to your flesh gets stronger. Every time you stand up in your spirit and you go, no, I select to do this other thing, you get stronger spiritually. So you put in the riches and the abundance and the resourcefulness into that place where it's not going to get lost in the world. If you build up riches in the world, you're going to lose them. Some of the most miserable people I know are the people that have amassed the most material riches around them. Especially if that's all they've got, they're really miserable because, you know, who can depend on that in today's markets? So those riches, begin to tap those inner riches that nothing in the material world can rob you of. And begin to move into that bountifulness that is the blessed state of living from that higher consciousness. You're anointed and appointed and empowered and called to be activated into that. In this show, in every show, and before you were born even, you stood and took those ancient vows before Archangel Michael, before the great central sun hierarchies, before the Lord Jesus. You stood before these great magistrates, and you said, yes, I pledge myself to come to Earth at this time to be of service in birthing the Golden Age. So to birth the Golden Age, we need to birth ourselves into our own Golden Age. And now is the time, and this is the opportunity to do that. So you don't have to understand anything spiritually, because what you're trying to understand is already a done deal. It's already inside of you. All you need to do is to awaken to the awareness of its presence within you. So when you awaken to the riches and the abundance and the bountifulness of who and what you are as a uniquely wrought son and daughter of God, a uniquely crafted instrument of divine creativity, divine beauty, divine resourcefulness. There's nothing that you cannot do, absolutely nothing, without the presence and the support of God. God backs you in every endeavor. Every endeavor, He's there backing you and supporting you and anointing you and appointing you and assuring your success. Whatsoever you do in the name of the Most High will succeed. Failure is not an option. You just gotta get in gear and keep moving with your energy flows, with your anointing, and with the desires and passions that arise out of selfless service, selfless giving, and imparting of the best you've got into your life at this time. So, that's my little cheer talk for tonight. I talk a little bit about my circus background because so many people have asked me to do that, and I don't usually go into that, but I'll let you know a little bit about why I'm such a tough old commander, and also why I value living on the edge, living on the wild side, and taking that quantum leap into the unknown, and doing it scared if you have to, but do it anyway, and transform that fear into empowerment, because that's what it's really for. So let's go out with a nice hue, and God willing, I'll be speaking to you next week. Deep breath. Adonai, beloveds.